The resentencing hearing for convicted child killer Joshua Phillips turns the spotlight on minors being tried and convicted as adults. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. You can also stream us live right now on Facebook. Just ahead, a closer look at Supreme Court decisions that have required the resentencing of minors like Joshua Phillips, who have been sentenced to life in prison. What do you think about juveniles looking at a lifetime in prison with no parole? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, how Florida is fighting both obesity and food insecurity. Plus, a preview of Avenue Q, a new production here on the First Coast, the Broadway hit coming to our area, all of that and more ahead. But first this hour, the resentencing hearing for Jacksonville's Joshua Phillips is going on this week at the downtown Duval County Courthouse. Now, back in 1999, Phillips murdered his 8-year-old neighbor, Maddie Clifton, and he hid her body under his bed for a week as the entire community frantically searched for her. Phillips was just 14 years old at the time, but he was tried and convicted as an adult and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Since Phillips' conviction, though, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that sentences like Phillips's are unconstitutional for juveniles, and that has led to hundreds of resentencing hearings around the country, including the one we're seeing here in Duval County right now. Phillips is now 33 years old. He's been described as a model prisoner, but prosecutors say his crime was so horrific he should never be allowed out of prison. The case of Joshua Phillips, again, is spurring debate about how minors who commit terrible crimes should be punished. Larry Hannon is a writer and researcher for Injustice Today. It's affiliated with Harvard University's Fair Punishment Project, and he joins us in studio. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. Do you remember the murder of Maddie Clifton? Maddie's killer, Joshua Phillips, was 14 at the time. And after a Supreme Court decision saying lifetime sentences for juveniles are unconstitutional, he's taking part in a resentencing hearing this week in Jacksonville. Do you think Phillips should be released? What are your thoughts about these sentences for juvenile killers? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on Facebook. We are streaming live there right now. And so this crime happened back in 1998, but many in the community obviously still remember the case of Maddie Clifton and yes. Joshua Phillips.
This was one of the biggest trials of the day. In fact, this is the last trial that's ever been moved out of Jacksonville. There was so much publicity, they moved it down to Bartow, which is where the trial actually occurred. Since then, they don't really move trials out of town anymore. You know, we've had cases like Michael Dunn, and they just don't do it anymore because of the cost. But it was, you know, we sarcastically refer to the trial of the century every couple of years, but this was definitely the trial of the century of 1999.
Right. Now, the details of the crime are all coming back out into court this week as prosecutors tell the assembled what happened. Maddie Clifton was 8 years old. Mm-hmm. She was stripped down of most of her clothes, beaten with a bat, and then Phillips stuffed her under his waterbed. He then plunged a knife into her chest and killed her and hid her under the bed for a week as the entire community searched for her. He was found guilty of first-degree murder in 1999 and automatically sentenced to life in prison. But since then, our criminal justice system has recast the way it looks at crimes committed by juveniles. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Our criminal justice system has radically changed the way it views juveniles who commit murder. Now, because they tried Joshua Phillips as an adult for first-degree murder, it was automatic he was getting life without parole because Florida law at the time mandated anyone sentenced to anyone convicted of first-degree murder gets life without parole, no exceptions. But the Supreme Court, in several rulings, one of the first of which was based on a case here in Jacksonville, has basically said that's unconstitutional and violates the Sixth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. The argument being that juveniles are still developing, their brains are still immature, and that the chance of rehabilitation is very strong with them. Therefore, throwing a 14-year-old in jail for the rest of his life is not something that you should do, because unlike a 35-year-old who would do something that's horrific, a 13-year-old can still be rehabilitated.
It's now seen by the system as cruel and unusual punishment.
Correct.
That doesn't provide comfort, however, to the loved ones of Maddie Clifton. Her mother was seen crying in the courtroom yesterday.
Yeah.
Emotionally, really acting out their hope that he stays in prison. So what about the counter argument that even though Phillips was a juvenile, this family has suffered so terribly, and certainly there will be those who disagree with the Supreme Court decision on these types of cases?
There are undoubtedly people who disagree, and I'm sure Bernie de la Rionda, the prosecutor in this case, is one of those who disagree. But, you know, to a certain extent, Judge Waddell Wallace, who is deciding Joshua Phillips's fate, has to follow what the U.S. Supreme Court has said. It's the highest court in the land, and the Supreme Court has said life sentences for juveniles should be incredibly rare. It's not something that should be automatic. You know, there is some debate as to whether the Supreme Court decision said there can never be a life sentence, but what the Supreme Court has absolutely said is it cannot be automatic. And the problem for people who want to keep Joshua Phillips in prison for the rest of their life is that he has been a model prisoner. And you can look at him and say that he is someone who seems to be much more likely to rehabilitate than others. And because he committed the crime so young, as much as, you know, the idea of a 14-year-old committing murder is horrific. But in a way, that's almost an argument for giving him a chance to get out, because he's had more time to rehabilitate. His brain was even more immature than most juveniles who commit murder. And so his age is, to a certain extent, an argument for why he should get out.
What do we know about the circumstances of the crime now, with the benefit of hindsight, that led Phillips to do this?
You know, it's impossible to know. He's had a lot, you know, he had clearly had some psychological issues. There were some issues with his family. You know, he did not have the he didn't have the worst experience growing up, but he certainly had some issues. But, you know, children have poor impulse control. It's one of those things where I don't think there's ever going to be a way to logically explain why a 14-year-old would commit murder. It's something we'll never understand.
Now, former state attorney Harry Shorstein is expected to testify this week on behalf of Joshua Phillips and say if he had known then what he knows now about juvenile brain development, he never would have sought a first-degree murder conviction. Shorstein's former lead prosecutor, though, Bernie de la Rionda, is going to ask the court to keep Phillips in prison. What can we, reading the tea leaves, what are some likely outcomes here?
You know, it's, I was trying to game that out last night, and it's tough to say. I mean, if you follow the text of the Supreme Court rulings, they are saying life sentences should be rare. Juveniles should have every chance to get out at some point in their lives. But this is Jacksonville. Jacksonville tends to have very harsh sentences. But at the same time, if Judge Wallace decides to resentence him to life, this will be appealed. And it's quite possible the appellate courts will look at what the U.S. Supreme Court has said and say, no, you can't do this. This is, you're directly violating what the U.S. Supreme Court said you should do. So I would not make a prediction. I think it could go just about any way.
And if the appellate court goes the other way, could Phillips be released, or would he still have to do some more time?
He's likely going to have to do some more time. I mean, trying to remember, I think he's probably going to have to do at least 30 years. He's basically been locked up for 19, 20 years now. I don't think at the end of this hearing he's going to walk out a free man. And I suspect if he gets a sentence of... And I believe the new law in Florida, there's now parole for people like this. So even if Wallace sentences him to something like life, I think in about 10 years he will get his case reviewed and he has a chance for parole then.
If you're just tuning in, Jacksonville is watching the resentencing hearing of Joshua Phillips this week. Phillips was just 14 when he killed 8-year-old Maddie Clifton back in 1999. But since then, the Supreme Court has ruled that juveniles cannot be sentenced to life in prison. What do you think about all this? Give us a call and give us a call with your thoughts and memories of the Maddie Clifton killing. It's 549-2937. March is on the west side. March, good morning.
Hello?
Hey, go ahead.
Yeah, it's Mark, M-A-R-K.
Oh, okay. We've got a typo here. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I do remember that trial and how horrific it was, and was moved out of town. But and this is Jacksonville, and there's nothing we can do to appease the family of Matty Clifton, I guess, except to let you know, kill this guy. But you know, every neurologist you talk to says, you know, 14-year-old person's brain, especially boys, are undeveloped. They don't even have frontal lobe and cortex and to process executive level decisions. So if anybody's going to be rehabilitated, like you said, it's this guy. And what is served by giving this guy another 10 or 20 years? This is just, just retribution to be mean. I mean, you know, you don't punish a blind person because he can't see. This guy should be let out, given a chance. I mean, he's been in, like you said, 12 or 13 years already. You know, another 10 years, what's that going to do? Just make him crazy? You let him out now.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, what the U.S. Supreme Court said, they didn't say it's absolutely wrong to sentence juveniles to life in prison. They said it can't be mandatory, which was what it was in the Joshua Phillips case, and that life sentences should be incredibly rare. Now, Joshua Phillips has been a model prisoner. You know, they've had jail officials come and testify in the last 2 days. If you read Eileen Kelly's excellent reporting in the Times Union, she's doing a very good job of covering this case. And he has been a model prisoner. He has gotten his high school diploma. He has gotten certified as a paralegal. I mean, it's just very hard looking at his history in prison to say that this is someone who should absolutely not get out.
Patrick on the South Side. Patrick, what do you think?
Hey, yeah, this guy's crime was so heinous and so ridiculously insane that in this model prisoner thing, if you've had any personal experience, unfortunately I have, you can become a model prisoner just by not doing what they say is wrong. He's not a model prisoner. This guy should have been executed, and that's the problem with the Supreme Court and everything. They judge by precedent and not by what's right. It's just the craziest thing I've ever seen. If it was your child that got done in that manner or any manner, they should be taken care of immediately, and that'll slow down all these other murders that can go sit on death row for the rest of their life, knowing they get away with it. Yeah. It's just crazy. This thing is crazy. He should have been executed and not even be in prison. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Okay. Hey, what do you say to the parents of Matty Clifton or the parents of any young child who look at this and say, if someone had done that to my child, I don't care if they were a juvenile or not, I want justice.
I mean, I can never, as a father myself, I cannot even comprehend what the family of Matty Clifton is going through. It's a parent's worst nightmare, and it's a terrible, terrible thing. But we have a major mass incarceration problem in this country, and any family who loses a child or an adult to violent crime, understandably, wants the person responsible to go away for the rest of their lives. But that's not the way it works. It's not, you know, locking up every single person who commits a violent crime for the rest of their life is not working.
But correct. That said, what about homicide? Which is really the worst of all crimes.
It is the worst of all crimes. But, you know, there are people who have committed murder and have gotten out 20, 30 years later and done, become wonderful people. Glenn Mitchell, who ran Compassionate Families after his son, Jeff, was murdered, ended up forming a bond with one of the people convicted for his son's death. And they ended up going around to high schools and stuff and talking after he got out. You know, it is possible to redeem people. I mean, I think if you're going to keep Joshua Phillips in jail, the only argument is that the crime was so horrific that there's no
justification. And to be clear, that's what the prosecutors are arguing. Okay. But, it appears we have Matty Clifton's cousin on the line, Jim on the north side. Hi, Jim. Good morning.
Good morning. How are y'all this morning?
Okay, thanks. So she was your cousin?
Yes, and I had visited with her just a week prior to this incident, and this is horrific. What about her life sentence? She didn't get to grow up. She was a beautiful little girl. And you're talking about a boy that wanted to hide a body so that he didn't get in trouble for hitting her with a baseball. This is ridiculous. To let a psycho, crazy guy out just because he was 14. Maddie didn't get to grow up and spend family. Where's her first prom at? Where's her life sentence? She don't have one. She was brutally murdered and hidden away while this boy even searched for her. To let some crazy kid like that out of jail is horrendous. I can't believe people would even think of that or even bring it up. I'm sorry, this is too much for me. And I'm sure the family is just at ends with themselves over this.
Yeah. So, Jim, tell me, she was your first cousin? Tell me a little more about it.
She was my second cousin, and she was a sweet little girl. She'd do anything for you. She was very nice. She'd go out of her way, you know, just to be the nicest little girl in the world. If that boy would have asked her, hey, you know, don't tell on me it was an accident, she would have been like, okay, and went continue playing at the party that they were at. Instead, look at where we're at now. We're talking about letting a guy that did something as horrendous as he did, hit the body, slept on it for a week, and let's just let him out of jail. Yeah, that's a good start. Yeah, he's very rehabilitated. I don't believe that in the least. And Patrick, that called beforehand, was right. People like that, juvenile or not, they should have their up and comings besides just sitting in jail for 30 years. That's ridiculous.
All right, Jim. I'm really sorry that your family's gone through this, and I so appreciate you calling and sharing that with us. And yeah. Clearly, this case, as like any homicide, my God, the pain that the victims' families go through is unfathomable.
Yeah.
And you can hear that in his voice. And so, you know, this is why adjudicating these cases is so difficult, Larry.
It's why it's so difficult, and quite frankly, it's why we've had laws that have mandated so many people getting locked up for the rest of their lives. And unfortunately, you know, we lock, but you know, and again, in no way am I, you know, minimizing the pain that Maddie Clifton's family or any family that suffered through a violent crime felt. But we lock up more people than Iran, than North Korea. And one of the reasons is we've locked up all these juveniles for life. And, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has said you can't do that anymore. Life sentences for juveniles have to be incredibly rare and the exception to the rule. And if Joshua Phillips is going to get a second life sentence, you have to argue that his crime is worse than most juvenile killers and that his chances of rehabilitation are worse than most juvenile killers. And I think that's going to be very hard for prosecutors to do.
Lots of tweets and emails and calls as we talk about the resentencing for Joshua Phillips, who killed Maddie Clifton, 8-year-old Maddie Clifton, back in 1999. Catalina tweets the show, much more research has been done on the adolescent brain since this trial. Sentences should focus more on psychological rehab, if possible. Brian tweets the show, the few glimpses of Phillips' home life make me feel sorry for him, but I feel sick for both Maddie Clifton and Phillips. Here's an email from a listener. In light of numerous studies that have come out showing that juveniles' brains continue to mature up to the age of 25, it seems foolish to put a 14-year-old in jail for life. People can change, especially juveniles. Therefore, it's in the public's interest to see that our judicial system have mercy. That's from Fabrizio. And lots of calls. Another call from someone who knew Maddie and Josh. It's Melissa. Melissa in downtown Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning. So I did grow up with Maddie and Josh. Well, I grew up with Maddie and Jesse and the Clifton family. And Josh lived across the street. And we actually weren't allowed to play with him when we were growing up just because of his family life and some of the behavior that he exhibited. And
can you tell, what did you know about his family life and what kind of behavior was he showing, Melissa?
Well, we knew his parents were gone a lot. And he was just always kind of not a bully, but like kind of an aggressive kid in some ways, like passive aggressiveness. I don't know. It's hard when you're like 10. I was, I guess 9 or 10, uh-huh. And Maddie was 8. And, cause I was right in between Jesse and Maddie. And, there was another incident with, I don't know, there was just a couple of things that happened, and basically all of our parents on that row just didn't really feel comfortable with us playing with him. And for me, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about how to come to terms with everything. But at the end of the day, this is a mental health issue. And he showed a lot of signs. Now that I'm older, I feel like he showed a lot of signs of antisocial personality disorder. And that's not about brain development, in my opinion. That's a psychological disorder. And I just, if there is going to be rehabilitation, which I'm also not a fan of life sentencing. So I do see the need to figure out what to do, but mental health is a huge issue and at the heart of what's going on here. And that doesn't mean that parole is the answer, in my opinion, if it's simply parole. So I just, it's really, this is hard. And I just hope that it's taken in larger context than just new developments in child psychology. So thank
you. And thank you so much for sharing that. It's incredible to get calls from folks with really close connections
really
to this.
Thanks for that,
Melissa. What about her comment?
Well, you know, if he gets out, they're not just going to say, you know, there's the door, bye. There's going to be an enormous number of conditions on him. He's going to be on probation for a while. He is going to be drug tested. He is going to be required to check in with a probation officer on a regular basis. And more than likely, he is going to be required to continue whatever psychological counseling he's gotten in prison. You know, sadly, prison is the biggest mental health provider in our country right now. And it's not always been the best mental health provider. But again, based on what we've heard in court this week, it sounds like he has actually made progress. Now, obviously, being in a structured environment of prison is not the same as being out, especially now that he's been locked up in prison much longer than he's ever been free. And it's going to be really hard for him. There's no question about it. But, you know, it's not like he's just going to wander away and never be seen again. You know, there's going to be regular people checking up on him if he gets out.
Well, we'll follow the case. It's happening now in the Duval County Courthouse. Larry Hannon with Injustice Today and Harvard's Fair Punishment Project. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Much more still ahead later. Broadway comes to town. We'll tell you about the local production of Avenue Q. But up next, a statewide effort to fight both obesity and food insecurity. Believe it or not, they go hand in hand. Back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, a California physician grapples with how and when to implement her state's new End of Life Option Act, which allows certain terminally ill patients to receive medical assistance to hasten death. Dr. Jessica Nuttig-Zitter is a critical care and palliative care specialist who often treats terminally ill patients. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Summertime is learning time. WJCT and the Jacksonville Public Library are partnering to help families fight the summer slide with educational programming and online resources that encourage learning at home. Log on to wjct.org/education/summer to find summer reading lists, activity books, early literacy development tools, and much more. Help your child prepare for the new school year at wjct.org/education/summer.
David Clark is the African-American Democratic sheriff in Milwaukee County. He's also 100% behind President Trump on immigration.
Well, I don't know how any law enforcement official can sit back with a straight face and say our communities are stronger because of illegal immigration.
Now, Clark says we need to do away with sanctuary cities.
These things are killing communities. They're killing cities.
On the next Reveal.
Thursday at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Folk, blues, jazz, R&B, country, western, Americana. It's all acoustic and it's all in one place. And that one place is String Theory. And you can hear String Theory Friday nights at 11 p.m. only on 89.9 WJCT. String Theory, the very best of modern acoustic music. This and every Friday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's a statewide effort focused on fighting both obesity and food insecurity. Now, this may seem a little counterintuitive, but they go hand in hand. You can be overweight and food insecure at the same time. Florida's family nutrition program is run through the University of Florida, and the idea is to focus on behavioral changes to promote a healthier lifestyle and also bring about better access to healthier foods in places known as food deserts, huge areas of the state where you can't get fresh produce. Here with more, we welcome Ashley Johnston and Denise Cox. They are with the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences Extension for Duval and Nassau counties. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having us.
Oh, thank you for being with us. And this is something that I think people might not realize, but obesity and food insecurity are sort of two sides of the same coin when we talk about this problem in this state, correct?
Definitely. We have, as you mentioned, quite a few food deserts in Duval County and Nassau County. Denise is here representing Nassau County. So something that we really try to focus on is educating people on how to shop in a healthy budget. And even if, you know, they only have access to a corner store, what are some of the fresh fruits and vegetables and things they can buy there, or ingredients they could combine to make it a more healthy meal?
Now, in Duval County, we have food deserts all over the city. As you said, Ashley, up in Nassau County, Denise, what's the situation like there?
Well, we have quite a bit there also. All of our schools now are a designated SNAP recipient families in the school. So It's all over. It's more prevalent than we think. As Ashley was saying, just in Duval, Clay, Nassau, and St. John's County, we have over 200,000 total SNAP recipient families. That's our Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And 170,000, that's 170,000 families or people here in Duval County alone. Huge,
yeah,
huge issue.
A lot of people. And so tell me a little more then about how this is, by the way, this is a statewide program.
Yes.
You're leading the charge here in Northeast Florida, but it's a statewide program, the Family Nutrition Program.
Yes, it is a statewide program. And I was speaking in the lobby earlier. This actually goes all the way back to the land grant days with Abe Lincoln. So every state has an extension office. And here in Florida, UF sort of owns that, quote unquote. So we have lots of different programs and services through our extension offices. And we're, again, here specifically representing Family Nutrition Program. And as you mentioned, we focus on the behavior change, which we know can be very difficult to change people's behaviors. And that's where we're using our evidence-based programs and services in order to do that.
And how do you change people's behaviors?
So we do things like cooking demos, grocery tour stores. We show them how to shop healthy on a budget. And we're also measuring their behaviors at the start and at the end to make sure that it's actually making a difference.
How do you get people into the program, Denise? How do you get them so that you can reach them and walk through the grocery store with them?
Well, we target the lower income populations who are receiving or are eligible to receive the SNAP benefits, like we said. We reach our audience where they work, where they play, where they shop, and where they eat. And the FNP,
and where they go to school.
And where they go
to school.
Right. I'll be starting in Nassau County, probably right after Labor Day is the goal, to going into the elementary schools at that time. In the meantime, we're doing adult education also. We reach audiences we partner with the schools, so like I just said. We go to daycare centers, the child care centers, and we also go to a lot of community sites, such as Head Start programs. We're in the food pantries at Barnabas right now in Nassau County. I go to the Callahan food pantry that they have, and they also do a presentation at their one in Amelia Island. We work in the libraries. We'll go to homeless shelters and churches. And the beautiful thing about our FNP program is, like Ashley said, we have demos and programs that cater to the different community sources that we go to. We have programs that are geared for our children. We have programs that are geared for our church audience. We're not a one size fits all shop. We cater to the needs of our community. And that's what is the most important thing here.
And going beyond that, your program as well, Ashley, you're trying to change people's behaviors and get people plugged into healthier eating. But you're looking at policy, too, for
Absolutely.
Florida. How are you trying to impact this at the policy level for Florida?
Right. So we recognize that health education, you know, we can only do so much when it comes to behavior change. The big change things that are going to happen are going to be through policy, systems, and environment. So we're in the schools doing school gardens. We're doing community gardens. Extension as a whole, you know, does summer camps and urban gardens and things like that. I'm on a number of different policy councils. I'm on the health advisory, the CHIP planning initiatives. So we're talking about sugar taxes. So anything we can do to support legislation for things like that, and even more sidewalks, we're all about it. Or increasing access to water. So that could be as simple as giving organizations a water cooler on site so that they can have something to drink when they're out in the hot sun.
How can people learn more about this program and get their school or their community involved?
Well, definitely reach out directly to me, the Duval County Extension office. Our number is 904-255-7450. And then the Family Nutrition Program as a whole also has a website, which is uffnp.org.
It's University of Florida's Family Nutrition Program. Ashley Johnston and Denise Cox, getting everybody in this area hopefully a little healthier, one step at a time. And particularly as kids go back to school, look for them in your child's school or after-school program. Ladies, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
Thank you for having us.
In a moment, the world of classical music conducting is a boys' club, but Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra has a new assistant conductor who's a woman. We'll meet her next.
I'm John Donvan. Next time on 1A, what exactly is a working vacation?
He played more golf last year than Tiger Woods.
Believe me, if I win this, I'm not going to be playing much golf.
More than half of all Americans don't use up all their vacation days, but even the president needs some downtime. Why are we so lousy at taking time off? That's next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Want to learn more about nutrition and weight loss? Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls Day Out Saturday, August 26th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Spend the day with experts that will engage you to be a better you. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, session, gift bag, and so much more. Tickets are just $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, September 16th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 event will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues. Learn new ways to engage students and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Welcome back. Well, the world of classical music conducting is often a boys' club, but the new assistant conductor with the Jacksonville Symphony is a woman. It's Deanna Tham. Now, she grew up thinking she'd become a doctor, but ended up in the world of music. Tham, a Northwestern University graduate, go Wildcats.
Go Wildcats.
Is also the principal conductor for Jacksonville Symphony Youth Orchestra, which will be going out on their first tour next summer on the West Coast. A pleasure to welcome my fellow NU grad to the studio. Deanna Tham, welcome to Jacksonville and good to meet you.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So exciting to see you as the new assistant conductor for the symphony.
Yeah, it's super exciting. I'm really excited and nervous for the season to start. So
yeah, and it's starting soon, isn't
starting
it?
Starting soon, yeah. Our single tickets go on sale on Monday. So yeah, we're rearing to go.
So as the assistant conductor, does that mean that you step in for Courtney Lewis at times, or what's your role with the symphony?
So assistant conductor is a lot of different hats. So I'll do a lot of the community engagement and family concerts as we go out to do in the community or even on our stage. We also have an associate conductor, Nathan Aspinall, and he does pops concerts. And then both of us do what's called cover conducting for Courtney or for any guest conductors. And so we sit in on rehearsals. We assist Courtney with the rehearsal process, what it sounds like in the hall. And then in the case, knock on wood, that he is unable to conduct the concert, which I hope does not happen, that would be the case where we step in.
Now, you grew up thinking you were going to go into medicine.
I did. I don't know where I got that idea.
How did you go from that to classical music?
Well, I joined the band. That's what happened.
Ah.
Yeah, I joined the band and just that it was just so different than everything that I thought I was supposed to do. And
what instrument did you play?
I was a French horn player in the band. Yeah. And then joined my local youth orchestra and all of that. And then got, you know, some chance to conduct when I was in the marching band and stuff. And that collaborative energy is just, I was really, really drawn to that.
And so you went to Northwestern, as I said, to study conducting.
I did. I got my master's degree at Northwestern in wind conducting and then did an additional orchestral conducting degree after that at the Cleveland Institute of Music.
It's a lot harder than it looks, isn't it?
I guess, you know, I think all grad students, you know, say, oh, being in grad school is really hard.
No, but I mean conducting, a conductor.
Yeah, being a conductor, you know, there are not a lot of job openings and things like that. You just have to really believe in what you do and your mission and believe that music is worthwhile.
Now, there's been a lot of discussion about how there's a gender bias in this world. Not a lot of female conductors. Why is that, and how have you dealt with that?
Well, it's definitely changing right now a lot. I have a lot of actually female colleagues who are conductors who are up and coming. There is only one woman on the, you know, kind of world stage as the conductor and music director of a major orchestra, and that's Marian Alsop at the Baltimore Symphony. I don't really think about it too much. You know, if I can be a role model for girls, which I've gotten that, you know, I've gotten mothers and their daughters come up to me and say that it's so great to see that. But I try to tell them, you know, I'm not great because I'm a woman in a man's field. I'm great because this is what I love to do, and I nurture my talent, and I work hard. And if I happen to be a woman, and for all women, that's where your value is. It's not the fact that you're a woman, but the fact that you work hard and you have a belief.
Yes. And so in addition to being the assistant conductor for the main symphony orchestra, you are the principal conductor for the Jacksonville Symphony Youth orchestras, and they are going on tour.
We are going on tour. We're going to Disneyland, and we're going to get to play in Disneyland and the Walt Disney Hall, which is great. That's where the LA Phil plays. So,
when does all that happen?
That's next June. So we'll spend the year preparing for that, and we'll be working on some really exciting repertoire for that.
And what's it like to conduct the kids?
It's wonderful. You know, I never thought I would really be in youth orchestra, but I love it. It's like, you know, conducting professionals who have played the repertoire many, many times. You know, it's different from conducting kids who this may be their first time with this exciting repertoire that's lasted 200 or 300 years. And it's like me relearning it and experiencing it for the first time all over.
Well, best of luck on that West Coast swing. And in the meantime, as you said, people need to go to jacksymphony.org. What can you tell us about the upcoming season? Tickets are about to go on sale.
Single tickets go on sale on Monday. And actually for Jacksonville Symphony Youth Orchestra, too, we have late auditions that are happening coming up. Deadline's the 15th and auditions are on the 19th. So check that out on jacksymphony.org. This season's super exciting. Lots of great repertoire. You should come check us out. And lots of pops and family concerts, too, for those families with kids who want something lighter.
Yeah. So many options at the symphony. Again, it's jacksymphony.org. Check it out online. And welcome to town, Deanna Tham, assistant conductor with the Jacksonville Symphony. Good to see you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Western Colorado has enough natural gas to power this entire country for more than 2 years. No drilling there yet, though.
It's just more profitable in other areas and other states that have a direct connection to bigger markets.
This is One Big Energy Market, gang. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The debate over natural gas, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
On the next Jazz Night in America, a look into the music of Rahsaan Roland Kirk.
People were drawn to Rahsaan. They could feel that he was given not 100%, but 2,000%.
Steve Touré leads the band, Bright Moments. That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the long-running Broadway smash Avenue Q opens on a First Coast stage this month. The Tony Award-winning musical is a coming-of-age parable set in New York City. Tony D'Amico is with Amelia Community Theater and one of the stars of Avenue Q. She joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having us back.
Oh, good to see you. Yeah. Now, this is a really great, popular, long-running, and funny musical.
Yes, it is.
It's sort of like Sesame Street on crack. And by the way, everybody listening, this is rated R.
It is.
This is not a family show.
It is not your grandma's puppet show.
No, it is not. So tell us about the show. For people that don't know the story, it's about young people trying to make it in New York.
Right.
And they're pretty upset because when they watched Sesame Street, they were told they were special and they could do anything. And then they realized maybe they're not so special after all.
I feel like all the characters are special. But Princeton comes to Avenue Q. He's just graduated from college. He's getting out there in the big world. And he realizes that he's gone through several avenues until he finally gets to Avenue Q, which
in
is
Manhattan.
Which is the rougher
Skid Row.
Right.
Yeah.
And the set, which was created by our volunteers at Amelia Community Theater, is an epitome of that street. And Vernon Long and Diana and Arthur Herman have done a fantastic job on this set. It is absolutely gorgeous. You can pull up some pictures on our Facebook page and stuff. But Princeton comes to town. He gets to this street, and he realizes it's not all that it's cracked up to be out there in the big world, but he sees an apartment for rent. The superintendent comes out, which is, by the way, Gary Coleman.
The real Gary Coleman, yeah. He's on the skids, too.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it's just how Princeton and all of the, and he meets all of his neighbors and how they all realize we've all got issues in life. We're all just trying to get along, and it's got some really great songs, really great messages, lots of fun, and lots of adult humor.
And this musical is known as well for its use of puppets, animated puppets.
Oh, yes.
How do the puppets interact with the stars and the actors on stage?
Okay, so the puppets, there are two categories of puppets. There are monster puppets, and then there are human puppets. And that plays in to the element of the message about racism. So they use monster puppets because they're totally different races. So that's how that incorporates into that. And then there are actually three human beings in the show, Christmas Eve, Brian, and Gary Coleman, and they're actual humans. but now actual humans run, you know, work the puppets. And so the story is basically told through the puppets. Princeton's a puppet. Kate Monster's a puppet. Mm-hmm. Nikki and Rod are puppets. Trekkie Monster, Kate Monster, as a puppet. So, you know, it's all incorporated through that. And that's why I think they used puppets, was it makes it easier and more pliable, I guess, to kind of get that message about racism across in a funny way.
And it's funny, too. I think it shocks the audience a little when these sweet-looking little Sesame Street-type puppets spew a lot of adult language.
They do.
Now, you're a puppet in the show. You play Mrs. T.
Yeah, I do. I play Mrs. T.
So you hear your voice, but we see a puppet. Is
yes,
that, right?
That is correct. And we're standing on stage with the puppets, and all the puppeteers are dressed in black. Mrs. T is a crabby old school teacher. And she hired Kate Monster to be her assistant in class. And somehow she regrets that eventually. But she, mm-hmm. what they talk about is she says, I should have never hired a monster. And then she says, why? Because monsters, their race is notoriously lazy. So it brings in that theme. There's a lot of great messages in this show through humor.
Yeah. And this is an ambitious production, by the way, for Amelia Community Theater with all of these moving parts. Mm-hmm. If you've never been, Amelia Community Theater is located in beautiful downtown Fernandina Beach, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And to me, you know, it's indicative of how Amelia has always just punched above its weight in terms of really high-level arts and culture offerings.
Yeah, we have a huge artist community in Fernandina and Amelia Island. And this theater has been in existence. This is wrapping up our 36th season. Mm-hmm. So we'll be going into our 37th season. It was the very first community theater on the island, established in 1981, and the only nonprofit theater on the island. And we work really well with our arts community, and we are so fortunate that a lot of the people in Avenue Q, they are coming from Jacksonville, actually, to participate in our theater in Fernandina. And we are so excited about that because we want to open the doors to anybody and everybody that wants to come and participate at our theater. You know, we have a lot of residents in Nassau County that volunteer at our theater, but we are also very welcoming to anybody who wants to come up and participate.
And it looks like Restaurant Orsay of Jacksonville is your sponsor for this show. So kudos to them.
Thank you, Restaurant Orsay. We appreciate that.
Avenue Q, by the way, one of the longest running shows, I did not know this, in Broadway history.
It celebrated its 14th birthday last week, actually. And they are currently still running off Broadway. And we were talking before we went on the air. They actually beat out Wicked in the year they were up for the Tony Awards. So, you know, I heard that the other day. So I thought that was extremely unique because Wicked is so popular.
Yeah.
You know, how could a puppet show beat out Wicked? But they did.
But they did. So if your curiosity is piqued, Avenue Q opens, what, tomorrow night?
Actually, tomorrow night.
Tomorrow
so we
night.
Have our final dress rehearsal tonight. So we're very excited.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, break a leg, Mrs.
Thank you. Thank you for having us back, Melissa. It's always nice to come up here and visit you.
You too. And she's Toni D'Amico, one of the stars of the Toni Award-winning Broadway smash Avenue Q, opening tomorrow night at Amelia Community Theater, now in their 36th season on the island. How about that? Get your tickets now at ameliacommunitytheater.org. If you've never been up there for a live show, you go on up, have some dinner up there, enjoy the beautiful Fernandina Beach, and see some great live theater. Toni, have a great time, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the show. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And never miss a show. If you download our WJCT app, you can listen to us anytime. We also put the podcast on iTunes. 1A's up next with a look at why more Americans don't take more time off. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Judges are confirming what listeners already know. The WJCT News team is among the best in the nation and the state of Florida. This year, WJCT News took home national awards for Best Arts Reporting and Best Talk Show, as well as statewide honors including Best Newscast and Best Continuing Coverage. For excellent journalism, stick with WJCTNews.org and 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your news.
If a hurricane threatens our state, Florida's public radio stations have joined forces to ensure you receive important storm information. No matter where you are, you can stay informed on the radio, online, on social media, and on the mobile app Florida Storms. Timely weather information is always available from WJCT. The Florida Public Radio Emergency Network is supported by Citizens Property Insurance. Online at citizensfla.com.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.